Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost.
Welcome to the October 26, 2014. We are so glad you're joining us tonight, and we appreciate your being here so much. And in the event of any technical difficulties, such as we had last week, please know that the show is always archived at the Progressive Radio Network website at prn.fm. You can click on shows and scroll down to the Lifeboat Hour, and you won't miss a beat. We have so much to talk about tonight, and it's so incredibly juicy that whereas I often play a song clip on the show, and whereas our guest is, among other things, a musician, I'm going to forego the song tonight so that we can fully immerse ourselves in the heart-resonating wisdom that he brings us. For the past few weeks, I haven't said much about the Ebola virus that threatens to become a global pandemic. I've read numerous articles about the disease and a number of conspiracy theories that posit that the disease was created by the powers that be and Big Pharma to control populations and make big bucks on a vaccine. While I do not dismiss the likelihood of some truth in these theories, I think that the most obvious and most frightening dot, really, that isn't being connected, is the role of environmental degradation. I refer to two articles. One is from The Guardian on October 3rd, entitled "How Saving West African Forests Might Have Prevented the Ebola Epidemic," and another one is from The Washington Post on July 8th, well in advance of the arrival of Ebola in the United States, entitled "How Deforestation Shares the Blame for the Ebola Epidemic." The reality is that deforestation causes humans to live closer to species that carry the virus, and the outbreak of Ebola is a glaring example of how disruption of the ecosystems backfires on humans sooner or later. My guest tonight knows more than a little bit about this, and many of you have read his books, and some of you have told me that your lives have been profoundly altered by his work. He is someone whose vision and laser focus I rely on in terms of eco-psychology and spirituality. He's also a fellow Coloradan living in the Animas Valley of southwestern Colorado, and the man I'm talking about is Bill Plotkin. He's a depth psychologist, wilderness guide, and an agent of cultural evolution. As founder of the Western Colorado's Animas Valley Institute in 1981, he has guided thousands of women and men through nature-based initiatory passages, including a contemporary Western adaptation of the Pan-Cultural Vision Quest. Previously, he's been a research psychologist studying non-ordinary states of consciousness, a professor of psychology, a psychotherapist, a rock musician, and a whitewater river guide. In 1979, on a solo winter trip back to the Adirondacks as he was climbing one of the peaks, Bill experienced a call to adventure. And this call led him to abandon academia in search of his true calling. Bill is the author of Soulcraft, Crossing into the Mysteries of Nature and Psyche, an experiential guidebook, and he's also the author of Nature and the Human Soul, Cultivating Wholeness and Community in a Fragmented World, a nature-based stage model of human development through the entire lifespan, and Wild Mind, a Field Guide to the Human Psyche, which is an ecocentric map of the psyche for healing, growing whole, and cultural transformation. He has a doctorate in psychology from the University of Colorado at Boulder, a little plug here from my hometown. And Bill Plotkin, welcome to the Lifeboat Hour.
It's a pleasure to be here with you, Carolyn. I'm grateful for the invitation and also grateful for your work, and which is very courageous and so important at this time.
Thank you so much, Bill. And I want to say at the outset to everyone listening that Bill and I don't particularly agree on everything. And for me, inviting guests to join me on the Lifeboat Hour is not about whether we agree on everything. But knowing that Bill and I probably have differing perspectives on some issues, I nevertheless wanted to invite him to come on the show to share his work, which for decades has been a beacon of light to many of us who are passionate about our intimate connection with the earth and the wildness in our DNA that we sometimes have a great deal of difficulty making sense of. One place where I believe Bill and I do solidly agree is on the desperate need for humans to be exploring and cultivating the soul. And that work profoundly influences our relationship with the earth, with other beings, and with ourselves. So let's begin the conversation. Bill, you and I have talked a bit about a slow collapse versus a fast one. And most of our listeners, I believe, are folks who have believed for a long time that our collapse was going to be slow. But due to what we're learning about catastrophic abrupt climate change, I would say that most of us now anticipate not a slow collapse, but a much more rapid demise that just might be delivered by Mother Nature herself in the form of droughts, extreme weather, floods, extinction of species, and of course, environmentally based pandemics. And although this show is called the Lifeboat Hour, and although Mike Rupert asked that the name remain the same when before his death he directed me to take it over, it may be that we are moving more from a perspective of building lifeboats to one of admitting ourselves to hospice for a stay there, a long stay or a short stay. I really don't know. I personally have trouble believing that near-term extinction means that every single member of the human species will be wiped from the earth. I think it is more likely that over time some will abide. What condition they're going to be in and what they will have the capacity to create, who knows? But Bill, if our ship is going down one way or the other, what are we to do during this time of collapse or near-term extinction or whatever might lie ahead?
A really big question. There's so many places we can go with that. Your question brings up the question about whether that's our best metaphor of ship going down and needing a lifeboat. I think it's worthwhile taking a look at it. Mm-hmm. I think a good place to start, because it's been such a helpful context for me, is something that we've heard from a elder who has been a great resource for many of us. I'm speaking of Joanna Macy. And she speaks about the three stories that are being lived in the world at this time, or at least three categories of stories. And the metaphors we use to address our situation might have a lot to do with what story we are understanding. And probably many of the listeners know what I'm referring to, that these three stories she calls the Great Turning, the Great Unraveling, and Business as Usual. And starting in the reverse order, business as usual is what maybe most people in the Western world are living. In other words, it's a story where basically the industrial growth society is humming along. We have bumps on the road every once in a while, but we're doing well enough. There's a lot of bad people out there that we label terrorists that we have to do something about, and we have some economic and ecological problems, but we're going to solve them all, and things are just going to keep getting better. So that's basically business as usual. That's the story that probably most people are still living. And then there's the story of the Great Unraveling. I think that's what Joanna calls it. Mm-hmm. And the Great Unraveling story is one that probably everybody listening to this show is aware of, and it brings up the question for if we would need lifeboats anyways, and that's the story that things are really bad. They're bad, especially ecologically. They're bad economically. They're bad in terms of politics and warfare and violence of all sorts all over the world. And part of this story might include the idea that our own species might go extinct soon. This idea of near-term extinction, which, as you and I have talked about, Carolyn, I don't feel it's a particularly useful idea, and maybe we'll get a chance to say more about that. And then the third story is the Great Turning, and that's the idea that we have come to a place in the story of humanity, and thereby the whole story of the planet, in which there's a major shift going on. And it's the shift or the transition from a suicidal and ecocidal industrial growth society, story of empire, shifting to the creation or the invention of life-sustaining cultures and new ones, and eventually, of course, life-enhancing cultures. And one thing that Joanna says about these three stories that I found really useful is that she said, in essence, this great turning story is really the biggest story, in the sense that it includes the great unraveling as a part of that story, and the great unraveling includes business as usual as a part of its story. And real briefly, the way that goes is something like this, that in order for the great turning to happen from unhealthy to healthy cultures, there has to be a kind of dying, a kind of ending, a kind of even catastrophe. And this is the great unraveling story. The great unraveling is in some ways necessary for the great turning. The way we find this in myths in all kinds of cultures is a simple reminder that we need a dying and a death before there's a rebirth. So there's the great unraveling is part of this great turning. It's a necessary part of it. It's a very difficult and terrifying part of it, but nevertheless it's a part of the great turning. And then for the great unraveling to happen, there has to be enough people who actually believe that we're basically okay and we can continue with business as usual, because that's what fuels the dying, the death of the old story, which is the great unraveling. So back to the lifeboat metaphor, if the story we're within is the great unraveling, then we're kind of like the Titanic that has already hit the iceberg and we're going down. And the question is, are there lifeboats? Are there enough lifeboats? Are there enough lifeboats for humans? Are there enough lifeboats for all the other species? But if the great turning is the story that we're living, then a lifeboat might be part of that. But it might be a useful metaphor, but the lifeboat within the great turning is not just for humans. It's for not only all the species, as many species that can be saved, but for the future generations of humans and also for all the other species. And but maybe a better metaphor within the great turning story is the pan-cultural sacred story of the descent to soul, which is the very core of the work that my colleagues and I have been doing at Animus Valley Institute for over 30 years, and maybe we'll get to that later. One last thing here for this initial question is that Joanna also tells us that, or suggests to us, that the Great Turning has three dimensions to it, and they're all important, they're all essential. And those dimensions, very briefly, are the first one is to save as much life as we can as the industrial growth society ship is going down, is collapsing. This is so essential to our own humanity as well as the Earth's health, is to save as much as we can in as many habitats. And the second dimension of the Great Turning is to understand the structure of the industrial growth society towards the end of helping us create new forms, new social and organizational practices, new forms for healthy culture. And that's very much been going on for quite some time, the last several decades for sure. In recent years, we're seeing just remarkable and very inspiring people, creative visionaries all over the world and organizations putting together and inventing pieces of healthy culture, which is not what we hear too much about in the mainstream news. And the third dimension that Joanna mentions of the Great Turning is the shift in values and consciousness, a fundamental shift in our own understanding of what it is to be human and what it is to be alive at this time. So hope that's helpful as some beginning comments.
Yeah, it really is. And one of the questions that you raised when you and I were dialoguing about questions is you actually raised the question, are we in the same circumstances as Noah? And so, you know, if our ship, the old story, is going down in something like slow motion, taking decades to go under rather than hours or minutes, and if our ship is not merely our economies and our ecologies, but the whole psychosocial order that we've been living in, our worldview, our entire mode of consciousness, really, then what are we to do during this collapse? Or on the other hand, if we don't have that much time, what are we to do?
Yeah, you know, the answer I've come to, Caroline, about this is that we do the same thing regardless of how much time we believe we have left.
Yes.
We do the best we can at being fully human. Mm. That's easy to say in a short sentence, and to unpack that is a lot. Maybe we could say in three books I've written so far, an attempt to unpack what do we mean by being fully human.
Yeah.
So maybe I'll just say a few things about that.
Please.
It means to be fully human. It means to participate in the more than human world, in the world that includes all these other species, in a way as a good member, as a cooperative member that honors the sacredness of all life and experiences all things in the world as alive and having their own voice and their own sovereignty and their own destiny. And to do our part, and this is easier said than done, and because it seems to me, and I know for you too, Caroline, and so many others, probably all the listeners, that over the last many hundred years, maybe thousands of years, maybe some would say 10,000 years, we in the Western cultures have lost our understanding of what it is to be fully human, and part of that is we've lost our practices and our ceremonies that help us become fully human, and in particular, we've lost our developmental practices and our rites of passage that help young humans become truly mature adults and elders. And I know one thing you know, Carolyn, from my work is that I've come to believe that there's actually a very small percentage of contemporary Western people, and really contemporary people of most cultures in the world, who ever reach at any age what is true adulthood, and so even less reach true elderhood. Elderhood is not just about being of a certain age, and nor is true adulthood. So for me, if we do think about it in terms of lifeboats for not only ourselves but other species and future generations, one of the most important things we can do, maybe in some ways it's most important, but maybe not most urgent, is to rediscover, reinvent, reclaim the practices that help young people grow up in a healthy way and enhances their chances of becoming fully human, and in particular, initiated adults and initiated elders. And really, that's that the primary work we've been doing at Animus Valley Institute here in Southwest Colorado the last 30-something years is creating at least one set of versions of contemporary nature-based and Western, contemporary Western society-based practices for helping people in particular go through the final stages of the long road towards true adulthood, these final stages being what I call the process of soul initiation. And this involves what we call the descent to soul, or the descent to the underworld, which, of course, we find in mythologies all over the world. And its goal is to the descent to soul, the process of soul initiation. Its goal is for an individual to die to their old story, to their adolescent story, no matter how healthy it might have been, and to discover the mystical elements of their of at the very core of their psyche, of their soul. And these mystical elements are the phrase we most prefer to use is a mythopoetic identity, or eco-poetic identity. So the word mythopoetic, it refers to this idea that we find in healthy cultures and mythologies all over the world, that at the very core of our psyches, there is a symbol or an image or a pattern or a theme or a mythic structure that is the very purpose of our individual lives. So in the process of soul initiation, which takes several months or years, it's not like a weekend workshop event, through the process of soul initiation and the descent to the underworld, the goal, you could say, is to go back to that very moment in which we're born or conceived, and to discover some symbol or some image or some pattern that is what we were born to live into the world. And this pattern or this mythopoetic identity is never, in cultural terms, it's never identified by a particular role, cultural role or vocation. Like in my case, the soul would never say, be a psychologist or an author or a vision fast guide or soulcraft guide or even an underworld guide. I don't believe the soul speaks in those kinds of terms. It speaks in metaphor. It speaks in mystical images. The contemporary British-American poet David White has a phrase we use often. He refers to the truth at the center of the image you were born with. The truth at the center of the image you were born with. That's a very mystical idea to most Western ears, this idea that when we're born, or maybe even conceived, there's an image that is birthed with us. And at the very core of that image is a certain kind of truth, and that's our particularly unique truth that we were born to live into the world. You might say it's our destiny to do that. And it's a kind of truth or image that we couldn't possibly understand as children or as adolescents, because the job, if you will, of a child or an adolescent, a teenager, is to learn their own culture, their own family and their culture and the language of their people and the history of their people, and to learn how to belong to the human species and a particular human community or village in particular. And through all those years of childhood and teen years, we get further and further distant from that original understanding that we're born with, but not that something we could explain when we're first birthed. We don't have the consciousness tool to do that yet. And so at some point in the midst of our adolescence, when we've created a persona, a social presence that works well enough and is authentic enough and has enough social acceptance by our peers, then in a healthy culture, the elders notice that we've gotten to that point and they whisk us away into an initiatory process of several months, if not years. And the goal is to forget, is to die to everything we thought we were and what we thought life was about, and to have this radical simplification of our life and our consciousness. And when ready to descend to those that very mystical, mythic realm where we can get a glimpse of the mysteries of the soul, the truth at the image of the at the center of the image we were born with.
So yep. In listening to you, I have to ask, let's imagine that, you know, I'm going to pretend to be 13 years old and I come to Animas Valley Institute or somehow we connect and, you know, I'm seeking something. And so, you know, if I'm going to be initiated in this way that you're speaking about, what might that look like in 2014?
Great question. Yeah, thanks. It brings up all kinds of issues. One is that we tend to, that most of us who have begun to remember or to learn about the rites of passage of nature-based people, we tend to think that the primary initiation is at puberty, say at about the age of 13. And actually, I've come to understand that that initiation is only one of several major passages in a lifetime. It's actually the model I developed and wrote about in the book Nature and the Human Soul. Puberty is only one of nine major life passages or major initiatory processes. And it's not the puberty is not the time we become adults, not psycho-spiritually. It's the time we become adolescents. And there's actually, in the model I've been working with for many years, there's actually two stages of adolescence. And so there's a major initiation after puberty, several years after, that I call confirmation. And I'll tell you about it in a minute, but first I need to say that confirmation is a major life passage that the majority of contemporary Western people never reach. They never earn that that passage because they haven't had enough success with the developmental tasks of the stages before that. So you asked if, let me say about confirmation. Confirmation is the major life passage that I was kind of alluding to a little while ago. It's the time in our life when we've created a social presence, a persona, a way of being in our society that works in the sense that it's authentic, it's real, it's true to our values as a human being, and it's socially acceptable. That you know, we get invited to parties and people like being with us. And this is a particularly challenging task in the contemporary Western world to be both real, to be socially authentic, and to be socially acceptable. It's something that most people have a great challenge with because of the difficult times that most contemporary people have in the two stages of childhood, which we can get to later if you'd like. But confirmation is that point when we basically have, we've created a social presence that could work for the rest of our life. We've learned how to be human in a way that works. And that's when the mystery or the soul and the agents of all the initiators and the elders notice us and say, great, this person has put together a way of being human. Now it's time for them to learn what it is to be fully human. It's time for them to descend to the depths. And this is confirming two things. It's confirming that they've got a social persona that works well enough, and it's also confirming that it's time to die to that entire adolescent story of what it is to be human and to begin the initiatory process towards adulthood. And in the contemporary Western context, as I say, I believe confirmation happens maybe only for 10 to 15% of contemporary humans. And when it does, age 16 or 17, I believe, is the earliest that happens. But for most Westerners, when that does happen, they're more likely to be in their early 20s or late 20s or in their 30s, or it might not happen until their 40s or 50s or never. Mm-hmm. So I'm saying this because you asked what would it look like, the initiatory right. process, if a 13-year-old came, and if a 13-year-old came, we'd refer them to someone else because they'd be too young for what we do. Mm-hmm. Most teenagers would not be ready for what we do.
Right.
But the usually the youngest people who come to us who are ready are college age, early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And what it looks like is almost everybody at comes to us needs to do what we call some foundational work before they're really ready for the descent. And so the kind of work we do to help them out, what we call the foundational work, is divides into two kinds. We call it wholing and self-healing. And wholing is kind of a strange word to most of our ears. It's I actually borrowed it from sacred psychologist Jean Houston.
Mm-hmm.
And she means becoming whole and cultivating the various dimensions of our innate humanity. And the map that I developed, that's actually in my most recent book, Wild Mind, suggests that there's four facets to our human wholeness. These are four facets of what I call the self, that's with a capital S, very similar to the way that Carl Jung used the word self, but not quite the same. And I think maybe right now is not the time to go into these four facets, but just to say that the foundational work that we do with people who come to us is to help them cultivate, develop the facets of wholeness that are weakest for them.
Mm-hmm.
And in other words, it kind of develops, it creates a more solid platform for there to dive off into the depths of soul. And the second aspect of the foundational work we call self-healing, that's self with a capital S, which is to say that we're healing ourselves with the resources of our innate human wholeness. And this is something that is relatively new to the field of psychotherapy, which tends to, most psychotherapists see themselves as the healer and the client as the one who's healed. And for many of our psychotherapy clients, that's what's needed. In fact, many of our clients don't have the resources they need to do their own healing. But at Animus Valley Institute, our primary work with healing is to help people cultivate their wholeness so they can do their own self-healing, which I believe is ultimately the strongest healing and where we need to get to. And so there's so many different kinds of practices we use here at Animus to help people with their wholing and self-healing. But once people are ready, and some people come to us and they're already ready, given the practices and the development they've done prior to coming to us. But in any case, when a person is ready, then there's many sets of practices, which collectively I call soulcraft, which are designed, and these are borrowed from traditions all over the world, but at Animus we especially use traditions and practices from the Western culture of mystical traditions. And these practices are help alter consciousness and bring people's awareness metaphorically down towards soul so that they can begin to glimpse this truth at the center of the image they were born with. And just to mention a few practices that everybody would be familiar with that we use is dream work. Would be the first one to mention a certain kind of dream work where we don't interpret dreams. In other words, we don't work on the dreams, but we help the dreams work on our own consciousness to help shift who we are, not just to add to our understanding of who we think we already are. And deep imagery work is another kind of practice. A third one that most people would be familiar with who are listeners to this show are contemporary vision quests or vision fasts, which involve being alone in a remote, wild or semi-wild place for 3 or 4 days fasting and using a variety of practices or ceremonies that deepen the descent. And there's probably 25 other sets of practices we use, but that might at least give people an initial idea.
Thank you for that very detailed and juicy answer. This is the Lifeboat Hour, and I'm your host, Carolyn Baker. Tonight, we're talking with Bill Plotkin, eco-psychologist, wilderness guide, and author. Bill, tell us how our listeners can get in contact with you.
All right, yeah, thanks for asking that. The website for Animus Valley Institute is www.animus.org.
And that's spelled A-N-I-M-A-S.
Yeah, thanks. It's really important to emphasize that because people often think I'm using the Jungian term, which is Latin, uh-huh. or the a masculine aspect of the psyche. The right. I pronounce it animus to make the distinction, but it's not. It's animus. It's actually here in Southwest Colorado. Some of the early Western people who got here were Spanish speaking, and so the name of the valley is animas, which is plural for souls. It's the Spanish missionaries who first got here referred to the native people who were living here as people who had lost their souls, which is kind of tragic and funny both, because it was actually the European people who had lost their souls, including
right.
the missionaries, and they projected that loss of soul onto the native people here who had not lost mm-hmm. their soul.
Mm-hmm.
And so they referred to this valley as the Valley of Souls Lost in Purgatory. Mm-hmm. And we still, of course, call it the Animus Valley. Anyway, so that's the best way to contact us initially. To find our other contact information is on our website, animus.org.
And at this point, I want to put in a huge plug for Bill's book, Nature and the Human Soul, Cultivating Wholeness and Community in a Fragmented World. And I love your other books, but I can't overstate the profundity of this one. It's like an encyclopedia of how human development should occur in a world where people are socialized to be ecocentric instead of egocentric. In fact, I have a friend who says, she says about Nature of the Human Soul that you can open the book up, let your eyes fall on any passage, and you're there for 3 days. So all of Bill's books are phenomenal, but I have to just say that Nature and the Human Soul is my favorite. Well, one of the core issues that you raise in all of your work and that you've just been talking about extensively, and that I focus on in all of my work, is the initiatory process that we're living through right now. As you say, one that might have begun 10,000 years ago. Has an initiatory process, has it been inevitable? Would it have been on any planet that evolved a species with conscious self-awareness and the liabilities as well as powers that the mode of consciousness we have engenders?
Yeah, you know, exactly. I think that's true. That's what I've come to believe. One way to say this is that I believe that the Earth has engaged in a really risky experiment by creating or evolving our species. Really risky. Maybe a necessary one. Maybe the Earth is going through an initiatory process, you might say at our own hands, that is somewhat analogous to the initiation of an individual human into adulthood. I think we could strain that analogy or metaphor if we pushed it too far, but there might be some interesting ideas there, that possibilities. There's something very troubling and maybe unique, maybe not unique, but certainly troubling and also holds great potential about us as humans. And that has to do with our mode of consciousness, that we're capable, because of our mode of consciousness, which includes an ego, we're actually capable of forgetting who we are. We're capable of not becoming fully human. And as far as we know, all the other species on this planet, at least most of them, maybe all of them, don't have trouble becoming who they're meant to be. They don't have identity crises. We don't imagine that salmon fish are wake up one day and decide that it's going to be too much trouble to swim back upriver to their spawning grounds, or that they'd rather be a bird than a fish. They don't have these kind of identity crises that we're quite famous for having. And it has to do with this mode of consciousness, that we're capable of knowing that we know. That's why I think we've named ourselves kind of in a self-congratulatory way, Homo sapiens sapiens, which means twice wise, that we know that we know. But it seems that one thing we know is that having this mode of consciousness enables us gives us the vulnerability or the liability to really forget who we truly are. And if we forget who we truly are, we're not going to be good participants in the more than human world, as we certainly see in the last couple of centuries, that how we have been mostly unconsciously, but in some ways consciously and systematically destroying other species and habitats. And I love the way, again, the poet David White refers to this in just a few lines. He says, "Sometimes I look out at everything growing so wild and faithfully beneath the sky and wonder why we are the one terrible part of creation privileged to refuse our flowering." Wonder why we are the one terrible part of creation privileged to refuse our flowering.
Yeah.
And I think that's true. Especially in not so healthy cultures like our contemporary Western culture, we refuse our flowering. We don't become fully human. We don't become initiated adults or elders. And it seems like this process in the Western culture started about 10,000 years ago, but I should add quickly here that there's lots and lots of examples of cultures that have destroyed themselves, non-Western cultures all over the world. We can think of Easter Island, for example, but there's many, many examples the anthropologists will give us. So it's not that this is the problem that we're having is only Western culture. It seems it's a liability of the human animal, and which makes our creation particularly risky. And again, this liability is forgetting who we are. Let me mention this, that as far as we know, at least 95% of the species we know on the planet don't actually need what we might call a culture to become a full adult member of that species. And most species, the parents are responsible for conception, and there's virtually no parenting. The young ones have the genetic endowment to develop into adults on their own without being shown how to do it. It seems like it's only the mammals and bird species that need what we might call culture, or need parenting, or need to be shown how to become, mature elk or mature eagles. And it's very much true for us humans as well. In fact, we might be kind of an extreme version that not only do we need parents and family and villages to help grow us, but we need at some point a set of initiatory practices to help us forget everything about our adolescent story, as I mentioned before, and to begin to descend towards soul. And when a culture loses its memory of its initiatory processes, not just its rites of passage, but its developmental processes that happen between the passages, which are actually more important than the passages, when we lose our knowledge of those developmental initiatory processes that are effective, then the culture begins to degrade, and its members become less than fully human, which seems what exactly has happened to us. And so when we say that this process in the Western world started maybe 10,000 years ago, it seems like, now I'm thinking of a great book I read many years ago called The Parable of the Tribes. The Parable of the Tribes by a historian called Andrew Schmuckler, Schmookler, I think. And in it, he asked the question, what did happen, what could have happened 10,000 years ago if there was a single tribe that became a what I would call a patho-adolescent or egocentric tribe that thought that having more of everything is a good idea, a good way to live, and that and that a tribe has started looking at its neighbor tribes and said, well, we'd like to have their resources, mm-hmm. their people as slaves, their land, etc., and that we'd be better and greater if we could have that. So if you just imagine that that happened with just one tribe, then Schmuckler asked, well, what would happen to the rest of the tribes? And to make a long story shorter, there's only a few possibilities that those other tribes would either be destroyed by the aggressor, the empire-building tribes, or that they would be assimilated within those tribes, or they would become just like that tribe, equally violent and pathological, or they would pick up and move as far away as they could. And basically what Schmuckler says is that's the history of the last 10,000 years. And the healthy tribes have no, in the last several hundred years, have had no place left to hide because the aggressor empire-based tribes have found them. And so we're at this incredible transition time on the planet now, where the habitat that our contemporary Western and other cultures control or inhabit is essentially the whole planet. We're not just going to destroy the ecology of our own island. It's the whole planetary system that's at stake now. And so you might say we are a planet at an extreme edge or end of a unavoidable initiatory process, and there's nobody knows what the outcome is going to be. But then we just have the question again, what are we to do?
One of the things I appreciate about nature and the human soul is, you know, it goes along so much with what Carl Jung said when he pointed out that initiation is something that is inherent in the human species, that something in us requires it, longs for it, demands it, and that somehow or other we'll get it one way or other. And so I don't have to tell you that there are many, many profane initiations around us and people trying to fulfill this desire for initiation, but in profane ways that have nothing to do with really finding out who we are. And so in my work, I write and speak constantly about the likelihood that we are going through a planetary initiation that is pulling us as a species down into the soul and demanding and compelling through all of these hardships, through all the destruction that we are creating to really discover who we are. And that this applies whether we have 2 more years or we have 200 more years. What do you think?
Yeah, it's a really interesting and poignant and I think a useful metaphor that, I want to actually emphasize it's a metaphor that we're saying initiation is a metaphor that,
right,
that there's this initiatory process that humans go through, to use another metaphor, going from a caterpillar to a butterfly, which requires going through this cocoon stage. In fact, that the cocoon is the earth metaphor that I've used to refer to the stage of healthy human life that I call it's late adolescence, actually, which most humans don't ever reach now. And the other phrase I use for this late adolescence stage, which is the fourth of eight stages, is the cocoon. We go through this extraordinary transformation, like from a caterpillar to a butterfly. So if we use that as a metaphor for what's going on with our species now, and it's a metaphor because I don't believe that species go through childhood, adolescence, adulthood, and elderhood, because if we did, that would imply that a species would naturally disappear after its elderhood. And I don't think that's not the way it works with species or cultures. That in fact, cultures are meant to just keep evolving. If they're healthy, they will keep evolving. And species, if they're good cooperators in the Earth community, species just keep evolving. They don't die. They can go extinct, but they don't die. So I think we need to be careful about our metaphors. But if we do use the initiation metaphor for what's going on the planet, we'd say, in some way the planet is going through an initiation. Can our planet Earth have a species that has conscious self-awareness without destroying its planet, its own planet?
Right.
Can we do that? And is that a descent to soul for the species? See, I actually don't think it is. I don't think species descend to soul. I think individual humans do.
Right.
But the way that, for me, this brings up what has become the most important question for me in the last 10 or 15 years, and that is, where do healthy human cultures come from?
Mm-hmm.
Do we just sit down with really intelligent people with PhDs and map one out and create one? I think maybe you could do that, but it'd probably be a waste of time if at best. That's not where healthy cultures come from. They come from the mysteries, from revelation, from the mythopoetic realm. And particularly the way I've understood it, where it comes from, where do healthy cultures come from, but how do healthy cultures keep evolving, keep changing to stay healthy? It comes through the visions or revelations of the adults, the people who've made it to true adulthood, and to receive a vision for what their particular little piece is to bring to their culture, their tribe, their village. And when you have a culture where most all of the people of a certain age, say in their 20s or later, are initiated adults, and they're all doing they've all found delivery systems for their mythopoetic identity. In other words, they found vocational and social ways to do or be what soul has asked them to do in a more symbolic way. Then that changes the culture, and it changes the culture in accordance with nature, because soul itself is nature, is from nature. So this is where healthy culture comes from, is from the initiated adults and the elders, which is, an elder is just not an older adult, and maybe we can get into the difference later if we have time. But I'm saying this to make the point that if our species is on an initiatory journey now, the process is about creating new cultural and contemporary cultural practices and forms that not only help adolescents go through the initiatory process to become adults, but help adolescents be healthy adolescents. And for that to happen, the children they had been previously have to be healthy children. And for the children to be healthy, their parents have to be healthy and mature. And for their parents to be healthy and mature, they have to be initiated adults who've gone through this initiatory process. And for that initiatory process to work, there have to be real elders in the culture. Mm-hmm. And for there to be real elders, there have to have been real adults. And you can see how it's circular here, and everything is dependent. Every stage of life in a healthy human culture is dependent on every other stage.
Absolutely. Well, I noticed that we have about 5 minutes left, and I'd like you to say just a little bit about psychotherapy. You know, I have to say, as a former psychotherapy, I'm sickened by our contemporary perspectives on human development and psychotherapy, which, as you emphasize, have been way too small. And as you say, at best, they've been about healing from trauma. So I'm wondering, what else do you think is missing from our contemporary perspectives on human development and psychotherapy?
Yeah, Carolyn, thanks for asking that. And in case listeners didn't catch this, I was a psychotherapist myself, a clinical psychologist practicing for, I don't know, something like 30 years. So I have a lot of appreciation for psychotherapy and where it can go and sometimes does. So, I think we've thought about psychotherapy way too small. We thought about it as primarily healing from trauma and healing our emotional wounds. And, of course, it is necessarily and appropriately about healing our emotional wounds. But I've come to believe that nobody ever is 100% healed. And right. If our goal for psychotherapy is a fully psychologically, emotionally healed person, we're never going to get there. You only need so much healing. And actually, I think something that's even more important than healing is what I talked about earlier is wholing, by which I mean cultivating what I call the four facets of our innate human wholeness. And there's what I've discovered is so many of our problems in living, so many of our emotional wounds are either healed or aren't so painful or aren't so much the issue anymore once we've cultivated our wholeness. And besides, once we're more whole, we're able to heal ourselves more effectively than any psychotherapist could do for us. So I've come to believe that the practices of wholing are generally more important in human development. But it's important to say there's some people who have been so wounded in our patho-adolescent egocentric culture that they can't do this for themselves. There's so many who really need a talented psychotherapist to help get them on the road to healing. I can't emphasize that enough. But then there are visionary psychologists like James Hillman who suggested the following, that one of the most healing things we can do for ourselves is to get ourselves out of the psychotherapist's office at some point and out into the world and volunteer our efforts to making this world a better place. There's so many thousands of ways to do that. And doing that, experiencing oneself as participating in what Joanna calls the great turning mm-hmm. and making a difference and helping other humans and other species and creating a foundation for future generations, this is profoundly healing to ourselves, maybe more than the best psychotherapy.
I totally agree with that. We are running out of time, and this is something that I have been, sharing with my life coaching clients for a very long time and emphasizing in my writing and teaching. So just quickly, Bill, can you tell us what projects you're working on now and what you might be doing in the future? And again, give your contact information.
Yeah, great. Thanks. Let's see, for many years, the most important thing I was doing was creating contemporary programs for to facilitate the process of soul initiation for individuals and with groups in a group context. And Animus Valley Institute is still very much doing that. And then somewhere around 15 or 20 years ago, I began to turn my attention to training guides to do the kind of work we do, which we call nature-based underworld guiding, and that became the most important work for me for many years, and it's still something we're very much involved with here at Animus. And just in the last couple of years, my attention has turned toward this question: what can we do? How can we contribute at Animus Valley Institute to developing the basic structure of the practices for the process of soul initiation that might be useful for several generations in the future, the future beings. In other words, I've started to have more of what Joanna Macy calls a deep time perspective, and I feel now that training guides who are alive now is actually not even as important as training guides for who might exist in future generations if the human species survives. And so that's where my attention has turned, and I think my next book will probably be on that particular topic. And again, the way to find more about my work and that of Animus Valley Institute is the website www.animus.org. That's animas.org.
Thank you so much, Bill Plotkin, for being my guest tonight on the Lifeboat Hour. And thank you, everyone out there, for joining us. We'll be back again next week.
Everybody knows that the dead, everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.